I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, we just have to accept that for some people, police officers will never be able to do their jobs well enough. And unfortunately, some of those people who believe that work at the Seattle Times. Also, beware of bribery ahead of the November election coming to you in the form of a refund check on your energy costs. And finally, I owe Democrats in Olympia an apology for suggesting they do not care about the working class. I'll explain that and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Welcome to our final live show of the week. We're going to bounce all over the place today on a bunch of different topics. I want to start with what has been going on just the last couple days of the legislative session, because we've been focused on bills and bad policy. But remember, they're also dealing with a budget. And one of the issues we talked about that was budget related a couple weeks ago now were bribes being inserted into the Democrat budget desires to send you guys checks, refund checks on your energy bills that would come right before you get your ballots for the November election, that would help offset the immense costs associated with Governor Inslee's Climate Commitment Act, which is also odd because I didn't think that the Climate Commitment Act was raising the cost of gas. So why would you need to send refund checks? All very bizarre. But one of the interesting things, so Todd Myers, our friend at the Washington Policy Center, he had come on the show a couple weeks ago and talked to us about what Democrats were proposing. And at the time, there were a couple different proposals. They said, look, we've got $150 million to send out refunds to the lowest income Washingtonians to help offset the costs of their energy bills because of the CCA. And at first, there was one proposal that would have said, let's send them half the money before the election and then half the money after the election. And if they repeal the CCA in November, well, we just won't send them the other half of that money because they repealed it. So I guess we can't send it to them then, which was crazy. So it was like a combination of a bribery and like a threat. And what they landed on, though, is sending out all of the $150 million before the November election. So here's Todd Myers' tweet, but it actually proves that what they were saying with that threat to like split it in half and, oh, if you repeal it, we can't give you the money. It proves what they did proves that that was just a lie. I mean, we knew it was a lie. We knew it was an empty threat. But Todd Myers said on Twitter, the final budget includes the $200 payments to utility customers from CCA funds. Grants must be paid by September 15th, 2024. So they're going to be paid to utility companies by September 15th. But when you see that, will probably be right before the November election. It says, he says, contrary to claims from House leaders who said if Initiative 2117 passed, the money for payments would be gone, it spends all $150 million before the election. So again, just proof that them saying, well, we can't send all the money up front because if they repeal this thing, we can't send them checks next year because the money will have disappeared. No, they have the $150 million. They've always had it. It's already come into them. It's sitting in an account. And they are now going to send that out. And what they said, if you're like, am I going to get one of these? Well, as we know from the chicken check debacle, you probably only get one if you're deceased. But this is what they say. They said, $150 million of the Climate Commitment Act account state appropriation is provided solely for the department to provide clean energy for Washington families grants for public and private electric utilities, to provide bill credits for low-income and moderate-income residential electricity customers to help with the clean energy transition in the amount of $200 per household by September 15th. And then it characterizes low and moderate income defined as less than 150% of the area median income. So if you're at less than 150% of the median income for your area, you can expect a $200 refund on your energy bills, which is just a drop in the bucket for what the CCA is costing you to begin with. And so that's why I want to encourage people, similar to Bob Ferguson's chicken refund checks that went to all sorts of people who didn't qualify for them, including deceased people, this is an effort at bribery. If they really cared about helping out low-income and moderate-income people, they wouldn't pass the CCA to begin with. Or at the very least, they would have been honest with you up front that it was going to increase gas prices, it was going to increase prices at the grocery store, it was going to increase energy prices, so you could have tried to plan accordingly and tried to, as most families have to, figure out a budget and how you were going to make it work. They didn't respect you enough to tell you the truth. They still don't respect you enough to tell you the truth. And now they respect you so little that they think they can buy you off with $200 so that when you have the initiative to repeal the CCA on the ballot in November, you'll be like, well, they did give me this $200, and they think you're dumb enough to say, oh, well, I guess that means that we can keep the CCA, which is going to continue to cost me over my lifetime thousands of dollars. Obviously, you guys are not dumb. And obviously, we respect you enough to tell you the truth. I did ask you guys, though, sometimes our daily show polls are like a test. Are our listeners still sane? Are they still in the land of sanity? And I send out a show poll to try to test that. I asked you guys, would receiving a one-time refund of $200 on your energy costs make you less likely to vote to repeal the CCA? Right now, 100% of people are saying no. That they would still vote to repeal the CCA. Jackie says, not only no, but hell no. We live in a rural area and gas and energy prices affect us a ton. So we will still be voting to repeal that bad boy. Julie says, I'd only vote yes if I had brain damage and didn't have the ability to think at all. Yeah, that sounds about right. Let's see what's going on over. I want to pull a couple more comments. Give me a second. Gosh, Brandy. Be prepared to read comments on your own show. What's wrong with you? Let me see here. Let me check it out on Patreon. Donald says, one-time refund would not equal the total amount I would be paying each year in the future. Yeah. E says they should be put in jail for bribery and election interference. No way I'm voting the way these jackasses want me to. I'd take the money and run to Reichert's campaign fund. Yeah, I heard some people gave their chicken checks to Dave Reichert's campaign fund, which I think is very funny. But yeah, your $200, like, look, I'm all for you giving the money back. Like, I'm not going to say no to that because that's money you took from people after you lied and said that it wouldn't cost them anything. So 100%, I'm not saying don't give the money back, but don't expect people to be swayed by $200 not to repeal your precious Climate Commitment Act. You better start figuring out right now what you're going to do when you lose that chunk of money that you're funneling into all these climate projects to pay your buddies and to maybe set up situation so you can get paid when you leave elected office and get some cushy climate-related job. You better figure that out right now because the CCA is going away in November. I can almost guarantee it. All right, we have some details on the public memorial coming up for Washington State Patrol Trooper Christopher Gadd. It's going to be happening next Tuesday, so this coming Tuesday, March 12th, 1 p.m. at the Angel of the Winds Arena in Everett. As always, these memorials are open to the public, so you will be able to attend if you want to. I wanted to bring this up today. I mean, we have a related story, but we will be attending, and so we will not have a show next Tuesday, March 12th. So I encourage any of you who are able on Tuesday to show up to show some support for Trooper Gadd's family, for the Washington State Patrol family, and also just for law enforcement that needs some encouragement in this political climate right now. They need to know that there are a ton of people out there who support them, who value them, who appreciate the hard work and the sacrifices that they give to keep our communities safe. So if you can make it, we would love for you to go. We will not have a show. We will remind you next Monday that we will not have a show on Tuesday as we go pay our respects to Trooper Christopher Gadd. Speaking of that case, we have a little more information on the suspect in Trooper Gadd's death. And we have said, and we talked about on the show yesterday, he's an illegal immigrant, been in the country for an unknown amount of time, but has a criminal history. I mean, at least going back to 2013, it seems like, though, there might be even some 2006 things that are on the radar. So I think that's still being sorted out. It's hard with records that go back that far to figure it out. But he's been in the country for a while. And there are and have been a lot of opportunities, we know, and we discussed on the show yesterday, to make sure that Raul Benitez Santana was removed from the country when he not only came here illegally, but when he broke the law and when he was caught breaking the law. And we're learning more about the timeline of some of his more serious criminal cases and what was happening in our state and in King County me at the time when it came to sanctuary policies. Because, you know, even you have the state sanctuary laws, then you have county sanctuary laws, for instance, and King County, you know, was ahead of the state when it came to implementation on that. So for a period of time in Washington, it really depended, I think, on where you might have committed a crime and whether that jurisdiction was willing to hand you over to ICE and to cooperate with ICE, etc. So this is from our friend Jason Rance. So we know that Santana, one of his criminal convictions had to do with domestic violence assault. The headline from Jason: sanctuary law protected illegal immigrant suspected in trooper's death. Jason writes, Santana was arrested for assaulting his on-again, off-again girlfriend, whom he'd had a five-month-old child with. The victim said she got into an argument with Santana over text messages he was getting from another female, according to King County court documents. Angry, his girlfriend grabbed Santana's phone and threw it. Santana responded by punching her 11 times. She was left with a swollen and bloodied face, a broken nose, and a bump above her right eye. Their child was present for the fight, but was not harmed. The assault took place in August 2017, and the case was resolved with a plea deal in May of 2019. If local agencies were able to ascertain Santana was in the country illegally, they could have offered information at that time to ICE so they could detain and ultimately remove him from the country. That means he wouldn't have, as Jason writes, been in a position to allegedly drive his car while high and drunk into 27-year-old State Trooper Christopher Gadd, killing him. So more on the timeline here from Jason's article. And this is fascinating. And, you know, obviously, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but it just showed that, you know, first of all, I don't believe in sanctuary policies the way that our state carries them out. But it, you know, going back into this timeline and realizing that, you know, 2 days after Jay Inslee made Washington a sanctuary state, 2 days after that, Santana got his plea deal in that domestic violence case. So I have to wonder, like, what would have happened if Inslee hadn't made Washington a sanctuary state? When he got his plea deal, would there have been some sort of cooperation with ICE? Jason's story says, 2 days after Washington Governor Jay Inslee signed Democrats' sanctuary state legislation into law, Santana, accepted a plea agreement for a domestic violence incident years earlier. He was in this country illegally at the time. Court documents indicate officials may have suspected his status as an illegal immigrant. And then he goes on to talk specific about King County. If law enforcement suspected Santana was an illegal immigrant when they first investigated the case in 2017, they would have, however, likely ignored it. By August of 2017, King County officials, along with the city of Seattle, proudly declared itself a sanctuary for illegal immigrants. It was an attempt to rebuff then-President Donald Trump's promise to clamp down on illegal immigration because of the obvious public safety implications. By 2019, when Santana was offered a non-felony plea deal with time served, county officials were legally prohibited from acting on Santana's citizenship status. So I get a lot of questions from, you know, no-name trolls on social media, like, this couldn't have been prevented, you know, they didn't know, or how could they have known? The bottom line is, in the timeline of Santana's criminal history in this country, not to mention he came here illegally in the first place, and then, yeah, he had some minor stuff. He had, like, driving with a suspended license. He had a couple speeding encounters. Those aren't instances where I necessarily believe that there would have been a full-fledged opportunity to hand him over to ICE. I even back in, you know, 2010, I don't think that you had the state patrol on a speeding case who was going to be like, hey, ICE, we got an illegal here, come and get him. But when you're talking about something like a serious domestic violence assault, guy punched his girlfriend 11 times, left her bruised and bloodied in front of their five-month-old. Yeah, that is an opportunity and would have been an opportunity to connect with ICE. Except at the time, King County wouldn't allow it and the city of Seattle wouldn't allow it. And even if it hadn't been in that jurisdiction, by the time this case was resolved, Washington State was officially a sanctuary state. It happened 2 days before the case was resolved. So it is because of our policies that he was not removed from the country. I firmly believe that. The death of Christopher Gadd, Trooper Gadd, the murder of Trooper Gadd was entirely preventable. And I also have to wonder, you know, I've been saying, gosh, we should have pulled this MSNBC clip. Maybe we can do it next week's show, but I don't know if you guys have seen it going around. They're kind of, it's Jen Psaki and who's the main MSNBC host, Rachel Maddow, and they're like giggling about how in Virginia voters are saying their top issue is immigration. And they're giggling about how silly that is. Like, mind you, we have all this news about Lake and Riley. The news just came out that the person who killed Christopher Gadd is in the country illegally. And so there's just such a disdain and disconnect for the reality that, yeah, we have people who are in this country illegally, who are breaking the law, beating NYPD officers to a bloody pulp in public. And do lawful American citizens commit horrible crimes? Yeah. But as I've said on the show before, gosh, I wish we could remove them from the country. I wish there was a country where we could say, hey, we don't want this like terrible human being here, so we're just going to ship him over to your country and let him just run across the border. You don't think that some of these Central American, South American countries are more than happy to see their worst citizens come over to us, and we have an opportunity to send them back and get them out of the country, and we don't take advantage of that, and people die as a result. American citizens are hurt as a result. So this has to be fixed. The Democrats in Washington state aren't going to fix it. I do wonder, isn't the State of the State or Union tonight, right? I wonder to what extent Biden's going to even talk about it, talk about border security. Will he bring up Lake and Riley? Will he even acknowledge any of this that's going on and the true danger that it poses to our country? I tend to think not. I tend to think he's probably going to talk about how Donald Trump hates immigrants and he's trying to stoke fear, et cetera, et cetera. But we just need to get back to reality and a reasonable way of talking about these things. Okay, coming up next, I have no clue why a bona fide news organization would take someone who has a disdain for police officers and put them on the police beat. But that is the case in the Seattle Times, and Mike Carter proves over and over again that he has an utter hatred of the police. And the Seattle Times should simply not allow him to continue to report on policing issues, because it does have a huge impact on police morale. First, I've been talking about the First Mark Challenge and why I think every single one of you should take it. First of all, it's free. You never pay First Mark anything. And the amount of energy and stress that they've saved Mike and I in dealing with our insurance needs. We took the First Mark Challenge about a year ago, and we talked to them about our insurance needs as a new couple. They went over our current insurance, you know, where we were at, what we needed and didn't need. They went out and shopped the market for us. We ended up getting much better insurance for the same price. So it was an absolute no-brainer for us. And now we love being a member of the First Mark family. They're constantly reviewing our insurance to make sure we have what we need. And they're constantly every year going out and seeing if they can get us better rates and save us money without us lifting a finger. I love it. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to First Mark, but at a minimum they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. And why do it if you don't have to do it? If you can have an insurance broker do it who's local for free, who's going to pick up the phone, an actual human being when you need something, as I've said, it really is a no-brainer. So schedule just an hour to take the First Mark Challenge. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. You can do it virtually or over the phone. And the very best part is they work for you, not the insurance company. So they are doing what is in the best interest of all of their clients. All right. There is a writer at the Seattle Times named Mike Carter. He's been around for ages. I mean, he's been at the Seattle Times forever. And back at the beginning of my career in Seattle, I was on the police beat. You might not know that, but so I came to Cairo Radio, gosh, 15 years ago was my first job. I was covering crime and justice. I then went to Fox 13. I covered crime and justice for a couple years in the courts before I switched over to politics. And so, you know, I had a lot of contact with Mike Carter. And this was also around the time of, you know, police in Seattle being, you know, the consent decree coming to be, where the federal government said, hey, Seattle police have this pattern or practice of excessive force. And so we're going to come in, we're going to do oversight. I mean, last, and then 12 years later, who would have known that that federal oversight, you know, would last so long? But Mike Carter has always been on that beat. But I would say, gosh, in the last 5 years or so, he has really amped up his clear bias against police officers. He just thinks police are horrible racist people. And look, like, if he wants to have that opinion, fine, but you can't have that opinion and then write what is supposed to be an unbiased, actual news article about the police. Of all the Seattle Times journalists, I cannot figure out why an actual newsroom would continue to ignore the clear animus that this rider has for law enforcement. So he published this article, the headline, Seattle Police Use of Force Nears All-Time Lows, But Racial Disparities Still Plague the Numbers. I'm going to read a little bit of this for you, but the bottom line is, you know, I think the overall headline, like, shouldn't we be celebrating this? Seattle Police Use of Force is, like, all-time low? Isn't that what you guys have been pushing for? Isn't that why the decade-long consent decree existed? Is you're like, they're using force too quick, and they're biased. But it's like, oh, their use of force number is an all-time low, but they're still racist pigs, is essentially like how I read that headline. So it says, the Office of Inspector General assessment confirmed the department's continued progress in using force less often and in using the least amount necessary. The analysis focused on 2021 through 2023, the years following 2020, when SPD's sometimes violent response to the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd skewed the numbers and proved a setback to efforts to end court oversight. See, in there, you see the bias in there. Their violent response to BLM protesters. That is his characterization. I was there. I think their response was entirely appropriate to the violence that they were faced with. He goes on to say, the inspector general found that those 3 years brought the lowest frequency of force by officers since 2015, the year the department began keeping detailed data following the adoption of stringent use of force policies and reporting requirements implemented as part of the settlement agreement with the Justice Department. At the same time, the data underscores troubling numbers from an assessment by a court-appointed monitor released in 2020 that found force was used by Seattle police on Black people and Native Americans at rates that far outstrip their representation in the city's population. There it is again, with, again, the insertion of clear bias. He calls them troubling numbers. That troubling's not in quotes. That is Mike Carter's assessment of when he looks at the numbers. He believes that they're troubling numbers. So let's look at the data in a chart where, again, it talks about racial disparities, like use of force, really low. However, use of force is still disproportionately being used on people of color. And so it says rates of use of force relative to white residents, and it goes through Black or African American, Hispanic or Latino. So basically, the way I read this data is for Black residents, it says in 2023, Black residents were 9.6 times more likely than white residents to experience use of force in an interaction with an SPD officer. They were also 12.5 times more likely than white residents to have a gun pointed at them by an officer. Rates were also higher among Hispanics and Latinos. However, they were lower among Asians. So Asians were less likely a percentage of the population to have force used against them by a police officer or to have a gun pointed at them by a police officer. But of course, and this is why I love this show, because gosh, if I said this on TV, I'd get fired immediately. But if I say it on our podcast, there's no problem with that at all. There is nothing in this article that speaks to whether Black people and Hispanics are committing crimes or engaging in behavior at higher rates than whites that would lead police to have to use force against them, that would lead police to have to pull out their gun during an arrest or during a traffic stop. This entire article and the entire focus of it suggests that the only possible reason why a police officer might use force against Black individuals at a higher rate than white individuals is racism. Is police bias, plain and simple. Not any sort of other issues. Are Black people committing crimes at higher rate? Are Black people committing more serious crimes at higher rate? Are Black people resisting arrest at higher rates? Are Black people engaging in behavior during those arrests that would lead police to believe that their life is at risk and that they need to draw their firearm at higher rates? You have to ask and answer those questions before you write an entire article that is based around an unproven premise that the only explanation for the disparity in data is racist cops. Not to mention, and something that Mike Carter doesn't even address in here, is that the Seattle Police Department has become far more diversified in its ranks than it was back in 2015 when the federal government came in for oversight, because their recruiting has really been about trying to diversify ranks, having a police department that better reflects the diversity of the community it serves. So you have a police department that is, over this 10 odd years, using force way less, using serious force way less. that is far more diverse than it once was, yet you still have disparities, racial disparities, when force is used, when a gun is drawn. Could it be, Mike Carter in the Seattle Times, that it's not the police being racist, that it is that there are a disproportionate number of people of color who are engaging in behavior that results in that? And if you really want to get serious about it, then you have to at least ask the question, and you have to try to figure out why. If that's the case, and it's not racist cops, as the Seattle Times has been suggesting for a decade plus, not to say there's not probably racist cops out there and that we didn't have a long history in this country of biased policing, but when you talk about the city of Seattle, you know, one of the probably at this point premier police agencies when it comes to use of force policies and everything they've been through with the federal consent decree. I mean, when you have that and you still have these outcomes, you got to start to ask questions about, okay, what else is going on and how can we address this? You know, I was reading, it's a long article, but even in this long article, no room to ask that because it's racist. Totally racist to suggest maybe there's disproportionate outcomes because of the people engaging in the behavior. The only like hint of it in the entire article is from the Seattle Inspector General, so overseas sort of policing, Lisa Judge, who said, this is a quote, this is the only hint of it in the whole article. Quote, the question is, how do we address and what do we change to better determine which are improper uses of force and which disparities can be attributed to other upstream factors? Exactly. And that quote touches on a key point. Nowhere in the article is Mike Carter able to say that any of the uses of force were improper, that any of the uses of force or the times that a police officer had to pull a firearm on a black suspect, that any of the times it violated policy, it violated the law, it wasn't appropriate. There is nothing in that data that suggests that police are acting improperly. There's nothing in that data that suggests that they should have pulled a gun on this white guy and they didn't. Nothing. Yet again, I would take you back to the word choice that Mike Carter uses. And I'm being hard on Mike Carter because this is a pattern of behavior that speaks to a larger bias at the Times. The Seattle Times, if it wants to be taken seriously as a journalistic entity, which is getting harder and harder to do, it has to realize that it cannot have a cop hater on the cop beat. If you want anyone to take you seriously, It's here in black and white. Again, the choice of the words, the data underscores troubling numbers. Are they troubling numbers? Because you're putting this through a police bias. Oh, it's racist police. Troubling numbers. All the little words he uses to vilify the police, their violent response to Black Lives Matter protesters. Never mind, you know, the protesters who tried to light the East Precinct on fire after locking cops inside. Never mind the protesters, rioters, who were throwing explosive devices at the police. Never mind the rioters who were burning, you know, lighting construction trailers on fire without even knowing whether there were people inside. Never mind all that. Yeah, the response to all that violence was so violent and inappropriate. It's really crazy stuff, but it speaks to what police are dealing with. Like, it'll never be enough. Never be enough. 10 years under a federal consent decree. All of the internal changes they've done to try to use force less, try to work on de-escalation, all the hours of training toward de-escalation, diversifying their ranks, more people of color, more women. It will never be enough. And meanwhile, crime is worse than it's ever been because you've handcuffed the police. And they're scared crapless to even have to put themselves in a situation where they might have to use force. Because even if their own bosses don't throw him under the bus or politicians in Seattle don't throw him under the bus, Bob Ferguson sure will. He'll take him to trial and he'll try to put him in prison for the rest of their lives. And then you've got the Seattle Times and Mike Carter circling the bases like, oh, if you don't get prosecuted, if A.G. Ferguson can't get you, if we can't get you, then we'll just talk crap about you in the Seattle Times. Police can't win. What do you want from them? Genuinely, what do you want from them? Oh, look, I don't want police using excessive force. I believe police have to be held accountable. I've said it a million times on the show. They get a badge and a gun and the power of the government. They can't run wild. They have to follow rules too. And if they break those rules, they should be held accountable 100%. But when you want to look at data like this and have the takeaway be cops are racist still, there's no helping you. You can't continue to write articles on the cop beat when you believe deep in your soul that every cop in the city of Seattle is a racist, horrible pig. That is not someone the Seattle Times should have writing stories about police officers. All right, coming up next, I have an apology, Nicole, to issue.
Oh, am I supposed to comment? Sorry.
I mean, it's serious.
And an apology? You haven't done any of those.
When I say something wrong, I take my job seriously, and I have to issue an apology to Democrats in Olympia. I owe them a heartfelt apology. So I'm going to get to that next.
Let's see about that.
What do you mean?
You don't think it's going to be hard?
You don't think it's going to be hurtful?
No, I just don't know if they really deserve it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, you know, I got to do it. I got to be above board, right? It can't be Mike Carter in the Seattle Times. When I'm wrong, I'm wrong. First, I've been talking to my friend Wes Jones. If you're thinking about buying or selling a home, by the way, I never talk about the fact that you can also call up our friend Wes Jones to buy a home. In fact, I got a text from a friend yesterday who shall remain named. She's kind of famous. You know, I can't put her on blast. She's like, you know, a good real estate agent? Wait. What did they say?
Shall remain named.
Shall remain unnamed. Did I not say that?
No, you did not say that. You said named.
I was like, my buddy Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. So whether you're selling your home or you're looking to buy a home, Wes Jones has been doing this for a long time. He's been through all the ups and downs in the real estate market. He and his team are great. Second to none marketing skills. They offer a lot of services you're also just not going to find anywhere else, particularly for home sellers. You know, they have something called a listing boost concierge service, where if you need to get your home ready for the market, you've got some repairs or updates, they can even help you pay for that up front, manage the whole project entirely. So give our friend Wes Jones a call, visit sellwithwes.com. He'll chat with you and he'll even come out and visit you in person.
I'll come out, it'll be me personally, and I'll come out, you know, kind of go through what our process is, assess your situation, and then, you know, at that point, if we're going to be working together, then, you know, we'll bring in the staging, I'll get it pre-inspected, and then we will do any of the repairs, any of the upgrades, and like, you know, when we start doing those types of activities, like, the more time, the better, you know, just so it's a little less stressful.
Yeah. And so while we're waiting for the Fed to drop interest rates, if you know you're going to sell your home in 2024, this is the time to get all of that stuff done. So when the time is ripe to hit the market, you are ready. Sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Start by simply using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. And make sure you ask Wes for a free market analysis, so your expectations are set for how your home might perform on the market. Sellwithwes.com. A better way to sell your home. All right. I owe Democrats in Olympia a sincere apology for suggesting that they do not care about the working class. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. I've said a lot this legislative session that Democrats have proven they don't care about the working class and the working poor. And I felt like I was making that assessment based on good data. I mean, the other night at 2 a.m., they passed a bill that will make life exceedingly more expensive for the working poor by spiking energy rates and eventually forcing homeowners to come out of pocket tens of thousands of dollars to electrify their home. You know, that comes on the back of the Climate Commitment Act, which they lied and said wouldn't raise gas prices. And it most definitely is raising gas prices, which has also raised prices at the grocery store and a variety of other things. And so there's all these policies that led me to believe that Democrats didn't care about the working class. And so I have really been firm on that, that they just really, really are not looking out for the interest of blue-collar Washingtonians and the working poor. But I was wrong. I was wrong because I forgot that Democrats passed a stripper's bill of rights. And who works harder than a stripper? That is not easy work. You're taking one of those pole dancing classes. That requires a lot of body strength.
You have?
That is blue collar work. And I failed, as someone pointed out to me, to talk about Senate Bill 6105, which offers protections for strippers in the workplace. Also helps to shed some of the really harmful lewd conduct policies that could get strip clubs and gay clubs raided unfairly. Also helps loosen the standards so you could serve booze in these establishments.
I didn't know we were the only state that doesn't allow alcohol.
wants to go watch strippers sober? Not me.
Not me.
And honestly, I don't want my husband going to watch strippers sober. If you're going to watch strippers, you better be drunk. You better be blitzed. So anyway, I forgot about the strippers, which, yeah, obviously strippers work very hard. And in fact, Democrats care so much about the working class and hardworking strippers that they actually took the time to go visit them at work. If that's not caring about the working class, I don't know what it is. The Stranger wrote this article. Lawmakers joined dancers and LGBTQ community in celebrating passage of Stripper Bill of Rights. They wrote, strippers, lawmakers, and the LGBTQ plus community gathered at Massive on Capitol Hill Saturday night to celebrate the passage of a bill to allow nudity in places that serve alcohol. The bill opened up a path for Washington strip clubs to serve liquor for the first time in about 50 years and broadened allowances for employees at queer bars to bare their nipples. The Stranger continues, among other things, the night previewed a future where adult entertainers can work in safer and more profitable clubs. As opposed to wandering into a dark, empty club, people waited in line stretching down the block to enter the Massive, a three-story queer bar with a giant dance floor and disco balls splashing light over go-go dancers shaking their asses on platforms. Up on the top floor, strippers performed impressive pole dancing routines as legislators tossed them singles.
They're such classy writers over there.
Washington State Rep. Amy Wallen, a Democrat from Kirkland, who sponsored the House version of the Stripper Bill of Rights, showed up just a little after 11 p.m. with her husband, Jim. A little before Wallen arrived, other lawmakers, including Seattle Reps. Liz Berry, Emily Alvarado, Daria Farviar, Julia Reed, and Tacoma Rep. Charlotte Mena, had gathered on stage to huge applause and cheers from the crowd for their work to eliminate the lewd conduct rules for places in Washington that serve alcohol. At one point, Mena grabbed the microphone and emphasized that the people in the club represented the real power behind this movement. So there it is. I am nothing if not humble and willing to admit when I have erred. And despite all those other reasons, I suggested that Washington Democrats do not care about the working class. Them showing up to stand up for strippers in the middle of the night on a Saturday proves that I was very, very wrong. And I apologize. All right, let's dip into some national news right now. A little chaos in New York. So if you go into the subway, so first of all, I used to live in New York. This is a long time ago, but I like saying it because it makes me sound cool. Oh, at least I used to live in New York City. I lived there for 6 months. I was dirt poor, couldn't afford food, and a glorified intern at CBS News. Okay, you want the truth? There it is, okay? But I used the subways quite a bit, and I'll say 15 years ago, I didn't think it was so bad. It was a little sweaty down there, smelled bad, but I didn't feel particularly unsafe. Obviously, things have changed in New York, so much so that the governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul, has called in the National Guard.
I'm redeploying nearly 1,000 members of the New York State Police, MTA Police, and MTA National Guard to conduct bag checks in the city's busiest transits. You'll start seeing them at the tables, making sure that weapons are not being brought in, working in concert with our New York State Police, as well as our NYPD. Because no one heading to their job or to visit family or to go to a doctor appointment should worry that the person sitting next to them possesses a deadly weapon.
Hey, you know, I actually think that it's well past time that we call in reinforcements to protect our transit system here. We've talked about all the violence that has occurred. They're having the same issue in New York. So look, like I said, like, hey, you want to come around and realize that, gosh, this has gotten so bad that we now need to do something about it to make it better. But then here's a tweet from Eric Adams. In light of all this, like, in his city, it's being patrolled by members of the National Guard with rifles. They're doing bag checks in and out of the turnstiles. Here's what Eric Adams tweets. Murders are down. Shootings are down, transit crime is down, car thefts are down, the safest big city in America just got even safer. You can't make up the level of tone deafness sometimes. And he talks about how from 2023, so a year ago, murders down 22%, shooting 16%, transit crime 15%, car theft 13%. And we all know that we hit some pretty horrible spikes during the pandemic, and there was a lot of lack of enforcement too, and I don't really trust data entirely. But even if you have transit crime down 15% year over year, it's so bad that as you sent that, the governor was sending in the National Guard. Probably not a good time to try to gaslight your citizens into believing that the safest big city in America just got even safer. Ridiculous. All right, speaking of safety in major cities, so we talk to my sister every week on Florida Report, which we will do momentarily, and one particular city in Florida that is a hub for tourists during spring break, Miami Beach, is taking some extraordinary measures to try to keep its citizens safe during the next couple weeks of partying. Let's talk about it in our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, we're going to talk about the spring break crackdown coming up next, which is hilarious. First, we did talk about DEI in Florida on the show already this week. I hope that Florida's going to set an example here of for the rest of the country of why DEI is such a bad thing.
Yeah, we do like to set trends, whether they're good or bad. We are trendsetters down here. But so Florida Board of Governors has basically said that any money spent in these DEI programs goes against like their rules and regulations, basically because DEI would spend money on people relating to directly to their race, gender identity, sexual orientation, country of origin, et cetera. So University of Florida is the first one to kind of pull the plug on that, eliminating all positions related to their DEI program, which is about 12 full-time jobs and 15 administrative appointments. So
that is insane that you would need 12 full-time jobs and administrative appointments to what, make sure you're not being racist? It's crazy. And to me, that's, I always say that about Washington State. When you have a state like Washington that's supposed to be uber progressive and, oh, we're better than all these other states, why do you need so many DEI initiatives then? Like, are your state employees racist? Are they going to be racist in their hiring practices? Are the citizens racist? I don't get it. So yeah. I love this. I got an, you know, I got an, not an argument, a back and forth with on Instagram over this. Wands? The guy who sings the hook on the Macklemore song, pop some tags, only got, which he's awesome. And he was, you know, commenting on, because he's from Washington, I assume. So maybe I had a DEI, I had an Instagram about Florida getting rid of its DEI programs, right? And he basically was like, well, you know, you don't understand what it's like not to, you know, just be a white lady. And I get it. But at the same time, you really think that if, like, why do you think Juan's got that hook on the Macklemore song? Because his voice was probably perfect for what Macklemore was looking for, and he's a talented performer. Now it's like, okay, imagine they gave that to a transgender person because they just wanted it to be a transgender person. You probably would have been pretty pissed off, right? DEI's racist as hell and bigoted as hell. So insane. All right, let's talk about spring break. So people might not know this about me, but back in my college days, I was quite the little party animal and I was quite the party animal. And because you lived in Miami, of course, that's a little cheaper. Like, we'll just stay with my sister and we'll go party spring break in Florida. And it was wild. Like, Miami Beach is crazy on spring break. Well, the city of Miami Beach put out a video, I'll play a clip of it, saying that they are breaking up with spring breakers.
Our idea of a good time is relaxing on the beach,
hitting up the spa,
or checking out a new restaurant.
You just want to get drunk in public and ignore laws.
Do you even remember what happened last March?
That was our breaking point, so we're breaking up with you.
And don't try to apologize and come crawling back. This isn't safe, so we're done.
And just so you know, we're serious.
This March, you can expect things like curfews, bag checks, and restricted beach access,
DUI checkpoints, $100 parking, and strong police enforcement for drug possession and violence.
Whatever it takes, because it's time to move on.
Maybe we can talk when you're done with your spring break phase, but until then.
So I saw that and I'm like, that can't be serious. Like, is it a joke or something? But no, even Ron DeSantis came out. He's like, we're going to help Miami crack down on spring breakers. Here's a clip.
And make no mistake about it, if you're coming here in order to enjoy Florida, enjoy to have a good time, fine. If you're coming for these other reasons, if you're committing crimes, causing havoc, you are going to pay the price. And we will hold you accountable because that's what we do here. I know you. Some people may be coming from other jurisdictions where they can get away with this type of activity. That is not going to fly in the Sunshine State.
So how are people reacting to this? I mean, has it been that bad in Miami Beach for spring break?
Yeah, honestly, like you said, even, you know, 15, 20 years ago when we used to party down here, it was bad, but it has just gotten exponentially worse. And I think Miami has just become one of those like trendy places to be. And it's not like, it's not college kids doing keg stands and listening to techno music. It is like full grown adults like coming down here during spring break and like causing the most obscene ruckus. Like last year, I think we had 4 shootings that led to death on South Beach. And, you know, I think it's important to like make a clear signal to people that just because you're here to party and it's spring break doesn't mean like laws don't exist. So the rules that they've put into place to kind of like quell the crowds a bit have been put in place before in an emergency effort, but now they're just putting them in place in advance to just maybe deter some people from even coming to South Beach to begin with.
Yeah. And so part of me is like, and first of all, you said they're not like we used to do 15, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I would have been 15. I was not in Miami partying spring break when I was 15, for the record. But so the first thing I was like, oh, good for them, you know, because it does get rowdy. But at the same time, I mean, don't businesses rely on that sort of rush during spring break to make money? Are they concerned about that?
Yeah, so I think most businesses that sit on the beach really do rely on the income of spring breakers. However, there's still only so many hotel rooms that can get filled up. There's only so many tables at restaurants, and that's still going to happen because a lot of the people that I think that are coming to Miami to enjoy spring break are flying in, taking an Uber to the beach, checking into their hotel, and like being a patron of the beach. However, because of all the crime, and a lot of it's like gun-related crime, those are people that are driving in, those are locals, I'm sorry. Like, so a lot of the things they're putting into effect are basically to cut down on the amount of parking, cut down on the amount of traffic just heading to the beach to cause these crowds that just loiter and get unruly. Most businesses, especially the ones on Ocean Drive that experience like the most spring breakers, they're actually kind of, they have mixed feelings, but they think it is like a necessary thing because a couple of business owners had said like a lot of the people that cause these issues aren't going to the restaurants. They're not shopping in the shops. They're standing on Ocean Drive, loitering until things get rowdy, causing fights. You know, and then there are some local businesses, like businesses that rely on local patrons that are going to lose a little bit this weekend and next weekend. Most of the people that go to their businesses are locals, and locals for the most part aren't going to be caught dead driving to South Beach this coming weekend.
Yeah. So my understanding was they're closing down basically like any parking garage, any public parking lot, so that you can't have these people, because Miami Beach and Miami are different, right? So you can have people drive in from Miami, but where are they going to park? They're not going to. Yeah. So is it gang members? Is that the concern here, is like stopping gang members from driving over and loitering?
I mean, the thing is like, probably yes. I don't hear a lot about like official like gangs in Miami. When you listen to the news, they're not like the so-and-so gang, you know. It's just, I think there's a lot of like out-of-town rivals coming in and people that maybe have beef just from every spring break. Like it's like a tradition for them to have beef. I don't know. But I think just like trying to cut back on the number of people that visit the beach this one time of the year just to like cause some problems. I don't know. I hate to think that people go over there just to cause problems, but you know, I mean, there's other rules too. They're going to shut the beaches down at like sundown, so you can't be out on the sand past sunset. There's towing fines that are doubled for people who are like coming in, and like, and the towing on the beach is already very expensive. Yeah. So that's definitely would stop me from going over there. You know, I think the police can only do so much with so many people. And if you go over there on this weekend, there are so many police officers. The police presence is huge, and that still doesn't stop this stuff from happening. So I think that them just trying to cut back on the number of people that are coming onto the beach is just going to help them in an effort to keep the crime down and just keep it cool, because everybody's supposed to be just like enjoying a weekend in Miami.
Right. If you're staying, like you said, if you're staying in a hotel, you're flying in, you're Ubering over, you know, you're doing all that shopping, all that. You're not the problem. You're not the issue. People who are coming in, driving over the bridge to congregate and get drunk and do coke or whatever it is, and then get into fights and shootings, that's the issue. So this is fascinating. I'm very interested to see how it goes. All right, Miranda, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's not even controversial anymore.
It's not
People
even
know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
I have some difficult news to share with all of you here on the podcast. I regret to inform you that Nicole's been fired. And effective immediately. Jeez, if you were not watching. So I had no idea that Nicole had... Did you ask Miranda for this?
I did. Yep.
That you resurrected an image of me on spring
in Miami. I mean,
when I was in college.
Look at that Farrah Fawcett hair.
Both, honestly. Why am I so tan?
You're so tan. I didn't know you could get that tan.
And I remember that dress very well. It was really short, by the way. So I'm glad you didn't find a full body shot. Mm-hmm. It was like this metallic silver short just below the bum dress. And we went out to these clubs in Miami, and I probably was 21, 22, probably 21.
That bleach blonde
or
hair.
Actually, I might not even have been 21, to
be
honest.
Well, let's say you're 21, because you're holding the cup there.
Yeah, but okay. All right, sure. I'm definitely 21. Definitely didn't use my sister's ID to get in after she'd used it. But yeah, Nicole, I don't know how you come back from this. I'm offended. I'm hurt.
Miranda warned me you were going to kill me. I said, as long as she doesn't look too drunk, it'll be fine.
Look too drunk would be the key there. All right, there you go. You never know what you're going to get on an episode of Undivided. Picture of me 20 years ago. Okay, we have been talking to our friend Zach Abraham about the state of the economy and also just some of the wild stuff going on that, you know, you hear about. For instance, we're going to talk today about Nvidia stock, which is just to the moon right now. But it's an example of when Zach and his team at Bulwark talk about risk management, and they see all these people getting excited about one particular stock and wanting to jump on board of something absolutely going through the roof, he and his team take a step back. And for people whose portfolios they're managing, they're like, let's really think this one through. Here's Zach. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Zach Abraham. Happy birthday to you. Nicole always leaves me hanging. Whenever I sing anyone happy birthday on the show, she refuses. And so then it's just me.
Cha-cha-cha.
Yeah, she could just add cha-cha-cha. Happy birthday, Zach.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
thank
God,
you so
you're
much.
Welcome. Thanks for being here on your birthday. There's so much to discuss.
You know, it's what's perverse is that if I got to do what I wanted to do on my birthday, it would include discussions on finance and economics. So
yeah, that is perverse. I was going to say, what is perverse? How does 35 feel? Good?
I mean, 7 years ago, it felt great. 42. I was saying something earlier today to the kids or something, and I went, oh no, I was emailing somebody, and I said something, and I had to catch myself, and I went, I've turned into my dad. You know, the gray hair and everything. It's just, it happens. Father time.
Yeah. Well, see, this is what happens when you support financially our podcast is we sing happy birthday to you and we kiss your ass and tell you you look 35.
So, hey, I'll take it.
That's great. I love it. All right. A couple things we're going to talk about Bitcoin, but also I want to talk about Nvidia. First, what is it? Because people are going to see that all over the place. So let's talk about what that stock is.
Yeah. So I felt like I needed to talk more about this when I got a call from a 90-year-old client the other day that wanted us to sell everything in his account and put it all in Nvidia. Okay. So, and we've been watching it go up. So Nvidia is a chip designing firm. They sell chips and they've developed, and they're the best chip designer firm, you know, in the world. They're a very good quality company. And then obviously this AI thing is coming, and they make a chip that runs faster than everybody else. And so it's optimal for AI usage, right? And so the whole AI thing's going up. So NVIDIA has seen a run that it is incomparable to any company in history, meaning, you know, in the space of less than 12 months, you've seen a company go from like $350 billion in market cap to $2.3 trillion, okay? And they're making unbelievable amounts of money, but the valuation of the stock has gotten so extreme that I've just said it's uninvestable. But it's sort of people are doing to NVIDIA kind of what they did with Tesla, right? Like where they legitimately thought Tesla will be the only auto manufacturer in the world, as stupid as that sounds. But people believed it, right? Now we're sitting here with Tesla's worth, what, 40, you know, 60% less, 40% of what it was worth, you know, a couple of years ago, right? We own a company called Taiwan Semiconductors, okay? They're up more in the last month than NVIDIA is, all right? And they're trading at like 26 times earnings. Well, guess who makes NVIDIA's chips? Taiwan Semiconductors. So if NVIDIA is going to be this hit, how does Taiwan Semiconductors not also benefit from it? And yet you're buying a rock solid company with a rock solid balance sheet trading at 26 times earnings. It doesn't make any sense, right? And I think AI is going to be a big deal, but you're in the middle of a bubble right now and people are being stupid. They're just being stupid and they're being greedy and they're being driven by the fear of missing out. And they're and again, it's not even a smart risk, because if NVIDIA is going to be all that it is, it's already gotten the majority of those gains. Go buy the stuff that's way cheaper and that hasn't gone through the roof yet, yeah. Right? And so, you know, it's tough to watch, because you know that people are going to really hurt themselves,
yeah.
Right? These are the moments where people really hurt themselves because they don't understand what they're doing, and yet things have been going up for so long that it's that classic adage of confusing brains with a bull market, right? Because you've made money in stocks, now you think you know what you're doing. And sadly, most people don't. And they're gonna pay the price. And the other tough thing about it, like I said, is there's just so much better stuff out there that hasn't gone through the roof yet.
Yeah, look, doesn't mean you can't have a little fun playing the stocks, but it depends how much risk you're willing to accept. And for a lot of us, we worked really hard for what we have in our retirement. And for some people, it's not even enough. You need to make it stretch. You need to be able to make sure that you've managed your risk appropriately to get you through the rest of your life. So with everything going on, you know, some of these crazy market fluctuations, the election, global unrest, rising cost of living, I suggest having a free Know Your Risk portfolio review with Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital. Bulwark's Know Your Risk portfolio review is a great way to just see if you're overexposed to risk. There's no obligation. In fact, Bulwark doesn't even let you invest with them at your first meeting. So schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com and make sure that you check out Zach's radio show, the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. All right, let's get to questions and comments. Was there something else I was going to joke about?
It's not even kind.
What are you doing, Nicole?
We're done with you, Miranda. Sorry.
Miranda, stop. Was there something else I was going to tell people about? I can't remember. Just talking about?
Maybe
the spring break picture.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. Okay, questions and comments. Ralph says, ICE should be involved whenever a person is an illegal immigrant, no matter what. They need to be sent back where they came from. I tend to kind of agree. I mean, honestly, if you're here illegally, that in and of itself should be reason to remove you from the country. You know, do I think that's the best thing in every case? No, I've already said I don't believe Dreamers should be removed. They were brought here as children. I think they should get a path to citizenship. But the point is that we need to, first of all, stop the hemorrhaging. Like, let's stop, because we can't deal with how many people have come in. And then let's take action to get people who have committed crimes here out of the country. Mimi Pentecost, is that your real name? That is a cool name. That's like that's like a Bond character.
Oh yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, Mimi Pentecost. Mm-hmm. Time to end sanctuary state. Vote these people out. It's only going to get worse. I agree. Bob Larson on the cop-hating Seattle Times. I laugh whenever I pick up Seattle Times and see they actually have an opinion section when it should be the whole damn paper. Merwin Wren says, Seattle Times is just the stranger in a freshly pressed suit.
Pretty much.
Oh, that's funny. You guys are funny.
We're good today.
Linda Sturrett Fogarty says the behavior of those women, Jen Psaki, Joy Reid, and Rachel Maddow, was absolutely disgusting and disrespectful of the truth. And Nicole, you have that clip, right? You want to play that for us since we talked about it?
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yeah. I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very, very contested area.
Build a wall. Like, what?
Yeah. So first of all, they're making fun of West Virginia, like, oh, we don't want us highbrow people in the Beltway. We don't want those West Virginians, you know, right wing knuckle draggers coming in. But it's also, you know, making fun of an issue that has been really serious lately when it comes to immigration, you know, fresh off the murder of Lake and Riley. It was also after the news that our state trooper was killed by an undocumented immigrant. So you're making fun of people in Virginia for having the border as a top issue when they're not a border state. But it just shows how disconnected you are. It shows how disrespectful you are. A better way to do it is to sit there and say, why is that? Like, let's talk about that. Why do we believe? Because Joy Reid had gone on this rant about how Donald Trump is just appealing to people's bias. All the issues that they push are about, oh, hating black people, hating Mexicans, whatever it is, and that's how people are voting. As if the only reason that someone in Virginia is concerned about the border is they're bigoted against people of color. It just shows, like, the whole Beltway, you know, whole, all the talking heads who are so disconnected from what people face in their everyday lives, and they can sit on their little set and they can laugh and they can giggle about the concerns of Americans, about things that are killing people. Sick, sad stuff. Greg Alakis says the Dems do this to secure votes. It's illegal and disgusting. What is he talking about? Sanctuary policies. Yeah. And with mail-in voting in all blue states, a.k.a. sanctuary cities, these are the problems that exist. Charlie Knowlton on SPD. The SPD has frequent ads to recruit more police officers. On Facebook, most of the feedback seems to reflect about recent history of the lack of support and backing our law enforcement. Yeah, you can't recruit. Sorry, nobody wants to work for SPD right now. I know that they are the highest paid law enforcement entity in the state. I think they still are. Port of Seattle is always sort of up there with them. But you can't buy someone's dignity. And you can try real dang hard to buy someone's dignity and try to give them a bonus for signing on or a lateral bonus. That bonus would have to be pretty dang high. Liz talking about Eric Adams in New York saying, oh, all the crime is down. No problems here. We've got the National Guard and our transit systems, but things are well. Liz says, liar. If you don't report crime or prosecute it, the numbers go down. Let's see. Todd Welch on the Stripper Bill of Rights. This was good legislation. Freedom for more government control in a private location. Now Washington Democrats should do this more. Remove more government restrictions on their lives. And I actually agree. I do agree. And I maybe should have made that clear while I was making fun of them for only caring about certain businesses and the success of certain businesses. As long as there's like an LGBTQ tie, they'll go to bat for you. But if you're, God forbid, you're a business that has no sort of intersectional, like, woke hierarchy, it's like, screw you. So that's my only issue with it is they, as Todd points out there, they increased regulation for everyone else unless you're a club where there's drag shows or strippers or whatever it is, then not only will we help you, we'll show up on a Saturday night and celebrate so we can get our photo ops in. But I do agree. Yeah, deregulate. You live free, nipples. That's what they were concerned about, right? Being able to serve booze while their nipples are out. Fine, I don't care. I mean, although if it's like a man chest, some hair there, and man, you're making those drinks awful close to a hairy man chest.
Well, it still has to be the like health inspection. Like,
yeah, you got to pass the health inspection. Yeah. What I'm saying is don't get your man chest hair in my shot. Okay? I've actually been to this club, so I'm not going to act as if. And it's actually a pretty fun club. It used to be called something else. I think it was called Q, right? I think it was called Q.
Couldn't tell you.
I mean, I've been learning to all a lot about the clubs. Up. Hey, I've got a lot of gay friends, and we've had a lot of fun up on Capitol Hill. I'm not going to act like I'm above drag shows. Love them. Just don't love them for kids. Strip clubs? I mean, not really my thing, but you do you. Anyway, okay, speaking of you do you, MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, the things that they will say to try to avoid a Trump presidency are borderline insane. Let's talk about it in our closing sanity check. All right, let me just play this video and we'll talk about it on the back end.
I think he's better than he's ever been intellectually, analytically.
Ooh.
Because he's been around for 50 years. And, you know, I don't know if people know this or not. Biden used to be a hothead. Sometimes that Irishman would get in front of the reasoning. Sometimes he would say things he didn't want to say. This is, and I don't really, you know what, I don't really care. Start your tape right now, because I'm about to tell you the truth. And F you if you can't handle the truth. This version of Biden, intellectually, analytically, is the best Biden ever. Not a close second. And I've known him for years. The Brzezinskis have known him for 50 years. If it weren't the truth, I wouldn't say it.
I love how halfway through that clip, he's like, start the tape right now because I'm about to tell the truth. Does that mean everything before that wasn't the truth? Because, like, you're on a news show, right? If the current version of Biden is the best Biden there's ever been, God help America. That has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. The legislative session ends tomorrow, Friday. It has been a freaking adventure. We will have one more episode of Politics Unpacked to unpack the final week of the legislative session. It'll be in your inboxes tomorrow morning. Also, a regular episode of Sundays with Subscribers coming up this week. We're going to decompress and talk about building political bridges after all the craziness we've been through in the last few months. So if you haven't become a subscriber already, you can sign up just $5 a month. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com.